This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Rest in peace, Rebecca Balding.
This is It Was a Thing on TV.
Total Red Man has ever done something like this to me!
It's a...
Ladies and gentlemen, I give you... The Dregs of Humanity!
Episode 291, submission number 967. Hot L Baltimore aired on ABC from January 24th to April 25th of 1975 for 13 episodes.
The following program deals with mature subject matter. Parental judgment and discretion are advised.
Before we get started, you didn't mishear Chico. The name of the show is Hot L Baltimore. It is hotel, but the E in the word hotel in the neon sign doesn't really work that well. So it is technically Hot L Baltimore. And if you do research in different areas, if you go to Wikipedia or what have you, it is called Hot L Baltimore. You will not find anything under Hotel Baltimore.
That's the joke.
So don't write us letters.
In 1973, Lanford Wilson wrote and performed in a play called The Hot L Baltimore. Apparently the play was so good that Norman Lear, who, by the way, is celebrating a birthday this week.
Yeah, he'll turn 100 on Wednesday.
Yep. So Norman Lear, in his genius, snatched up the rights to make a sitcom off of this play. And the plot is, well, it is Norman Lear at its heart. Steamy, racy for the time, and somewhat stilted on the absurd, but the realistically absurd. Not the absurd like there's an alien on your shoulder named Osmodiar.
And you actually heard in the open the little viewer advisory warning from ABC. It was definitely not for the kids.
Nope.
Well, you know what? I think nowadays, and I'm not saying it's for the kids nowadays, but this wouldn't cause such a fury in 2022. But it's one of those things in 1975 where, yeah, we got to warn people to put the kids away. And, yeah, if you've got some heart issues, you may not want to watch this. If you've got certain moral or religious beliefs, you may not want to watch this.
And if you have a string of pearls, you may want to start clutching them now.
Yeah.
But nowadays, in 2022, you probably look at this and think, meh. But much like the Hot L Baltimore in the play, the Hot L Baltimore takes its reputation and its name from the fact that the E in hotel has burned out and has not been replaced. It was typical of the hotels in Baltimore, built usually in the 1800s to the jazz age.
But really, a lot of the controversy comes with who was in the hotel.
The guests or the staff?
Why not both?
The guests or the staff? The correct answer is yes.
You had two prostitutes who worked at the hotel. Oh, one of those prostitutes happened to be an illegal immigrant from Colombia.
Oh, no.
No.
And then also you had one of the first gay couples on American television. So you had prostitutes and you had gays. And I can hear from here Archie Bunker, Carol O'Connor, having a friggin' fit. Even though he's been dead for, what, close to 30 years now.
So, who populated the Hot L Baltimore? Well, it was your standard assortment of colorful characters, even more colorful made possible by the fact that they were developed by Norman Lear and sourced from a very cheeky play. Our hotel's desk clerk is played by James Cromwell, who, of course, you would know as, come on, what don't you know him from?
I mean, I think we just got to start off with Babe. I think that's where he really made his name, was Babe.
And of course, if you're like Greg and myself, you know him best as Zefram Cochrane in Star Trek First Contact.
Well, that, and also for me, that one Wendy's commercial he was in. I think I showed you that one Wendy's commercial James Cromwell was in that one time. Didn't I?
You've shown it. I've seen it. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll just play it here.
Sir, would you choose hamburger A, a Wendy's hamburger made with fresh beef, or B, made with beef that's been frozen?
Hamburger B.
Why?
Looks like the chow we had in the Marines.
Was it good?
No, it was terrible, but what memories. Slogging chest deep through the muck, mosquitoes as big as choppers, smell of sulfur in the air, I loved it. Say, were you in the Corps?
No.
I didn't think so.
Most people prefer hamburgers made with fresh beef, like Wendy's, the best burgers in the business.
And actually, more recently, where I know him from is he played Natalie Z's dad on one of my favorite series, at least for the first two seasons before it went way downhill, The Detour.
And I just remembered that he is a recurring player on one of my new favorite shows that I like to stream on HBO Max, Succession.
Don't worry, folks. When season four comes around, we are going to do Going Places for Alan Ruck. Okay? We're going to do Going Places.
We're just waiting for when season four is going to drop. And they are working on it right now, from what I understand.
And let's be honest, we all want to sing that Going Places theme song.
Hell yeah. So there's your desk clerk. He is overseen by the young manager, Clifford Ainsley, played by Richard Mazur, who you'd probably remember from season two of One Day at a Time. He was also a very prolific That Guy from That Thing. If you are a fan of L.A. Law, you may have caught him in four episodes playing three different characters.
Watch out for the elevator shaft.
Oh, no.
I really don't want to talk about it.
Ah! Oh, my God!
No, Diana Muldaur, don't go down the elevator shaft. Oh, too late.
Yeah. Too late. Somebody should have warned her.
Yeah, that never gets old. April Green, a prostitute who happens to like Bill, is played by Conchata Farrell, who you would best remember as Berta from Two and a Half Men.
And she was also on L.A. Law.
We're not playing that clip again.
No, I know. We're not going to play the Diana Muldaur clip twice. We have standards. We're not going to do that.
Right.
Speak for yourself.
I really don't want to talk about it.
Another prostitute, Susie Marta Rocket, is played by Jeannie Lanero, who you would probably remember playing Lucy Mancini in two of the three Godfather movies. Sadly, she is no longer with us. She died at the age of 60 in 2005.
No.
Before the Godfather, she was all over the place. She was in Chico and the Man, All of the Family.
Is it fair to assume that she may have been the illegal immigrant prostitute?
She is the illegal immigrant prostitute.
Not often we get to say illegal immigrant prostitute on this podcast, so I just want to take advantage of it.
Yeah, okay. What was she again?
A prostitute?
Who is?
Just sit down. I don't want you to flip out. She was an illegal immigrant.
And she was also a...
I already said she was a prostitute who was an illegal immigrant.
Okay.
She was a prostitute who was an immigrant who was not here legally.
Mr. Black.
Would have a f***ing conniption over that.
All right. Other people on the staff include the wise Charles Bingham, played by Al Freeman Jr., who you probably remember as Elijah Muhammad in Malcolm X. That's pretty much the highlight of his career. And then you have Daffy Waitress Millie, played by Gloria LeRoy, who was in... What was Gloria LeRoy in?
She was in a lot, but she wasn't a recurring character in many shows.
She was a That Woman from That Thing, but she played Evelyn on a 1997 episode of Family Matters. I do not remember the subject of that episode, but suffice it to say, she got around.
It's a last season episode.
Oh, that explains it. It certainly wasn't the episode with Sherman Helmsley and the stripper that Carl saw at the Boom Boom Room.
No. All I saw when pulling up the episode she was on, the first word I saw is Stefan, and it's like, oh no, it's a Stefan last season episode.
Stefan Urkel.
Stefan. I think Stefan Diggs. That's why I say Stefan, but whatever. Jaleel White's alternative character, whatever you want to call it, doppelganger. And we talked about that previously on It Lasted One Season Too Long.
And then you have 13-year-old Runaway and Tomboy Jackie, played by Robin Wilson. This is pretty much the apex of Robin's career. So perhaps not 13 at all, but I don't know where I pulled 13. But she was a young tomboy and a runaway. The grouchy old codger of the group, Mr. Morse, was played by Stan Gottlieb. He played a hobo in Slaughterhouse-Five, but this was his final starring role. And then you have a middle-aged man named George, played by Lee Berger, who is known for a whole lot of characters, playing Abraham Lincoln in an episode of Star Trek. I wish I was kidding, I'm not. He also played Joseph Anders in 58 episodes of Dynasty.
I'm sorry, I was muted, but yeah, everyone remembers that episode of Star Trek with Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln just randomly shows up in Kirk's viewfinder.
Didn't make any sense, but it was Star Trek. And it was the last season of Star Trek, so...
Oh, yeah, at this point...
Fred Freiberger was willing to try anything.
Gene Roddenberry was like, screw it, just do anything.
And it's like, Gene Roddenberry was like, screw it, just do it. And Fred Freiberger was like, okay. And then we have Gordon, who is George's live-in boyfriend, played by Henry Calvert. He was not in much. I mean, his greatest role was in 1976, All the President's Men, as Bernard Barker. And finally, an eccentric woman, Mrs. Bellotti, with a never-seen psychotic son, is played by Charlotte Ray. I want to say this is the last role she had until Different Strokes, and we all know what happens with Different Strokes.
Well, Different Strokes wasn't until 78, 79, wasn't it?
Basically. But I think this might have been her last regular series before Different Strokes.
Okay.
Yeah, this is her last regular role before Edna Garrett on Different Strokes, and then obviously eventually Facts of Life, and also, let's say it, Hello, Larry.
Hello, Larry!
And if you've never seen Facts of Life, or if you've never seen... Well, obviously, you've heard of Hello, Larry if you've been around here long enough. If you've never seen Different Strokes, you're like 12. And the thing is, if you want to go even further back, she played Al Lewis's wife, Sylvia, on Car 54, Where Are You?
What?
Yeah, she was Al Lewis's wife, Sylvia Schnauzer. I love Car 54, Where Are You?
I bet
you. So, start with Ed Gwynn. Go down to Joey Ross, and you've got Nipsey Russell, and you've got Charlotte Ray. What's not to love?
Yeah. And if you are of a certain age, you remember her as Molly the Mail Lady on Sesame Street. Again, if you are of a certain age. Greg, Mike, and I, not of that age yet. So that's your crew and or your guests at the Hot L Baltimore. So we all know what would happen when they're in a play, but when they're doing this sort of thing on the regular, what kind of shenanigans, what kind of hilarity would ensue with these guys, I wonder? Let's find out.
Boy, I wonder what shenanigans occur when you have two prostitutes and a gay couple.
And an old codger, a runaway, and an eccentric old lady with a psychotic son.
And actually, I should also add, yes, I know we went through a lot of people there, probably close to a dozen people. That was the opening to the show. They had 10 different credits, at least, for the people in the hotel. That may be not even including your James Cromwell and mm-hmm. your staff. It was a long sequence, and you had two people generally on the screen at all times for the credits, that is. So let's see what shenanigans happen at the Hotel Baltimore.
All right, episode one, Susie's wedding. Susie announces she's going to marry a Hollywood producer because, you know, she's here illegally and she has to marry somebody, so why not marry for love?
That doesn't happen nowadays.
She's not marrying for love, is she?
She's a prostitute. What do you think she's marrying for?
She's a prostitute who's in the country illegally.
Yeah, she's not marrying for love.
Yeah. Playing the role of the producer is Philip Bruns, who is best known as Frank Szabo in Flashdance.
We've talked about him in the past.
Yeah, we have.
He was on an episode of the Ghostbusters. He was on the episode The Flying Dutchman.
He played the Flying Dutchman. No, he played Scroggs. There was another person who was. He's not known enough to play the villain in an episode of the Ghostbusters.
But he's known well enough to be on this podcast.
Episode two, Millie's Beau. Millie's new boyfriend turns out to be one of Susie's clients.
Uh-oh.
The residents try to figure out a way to tell Millie. Oh, boy. Playing Ronald Shelburne, the lucky stiff, is Phil Leeds, who is...
We've talked about him plenty of times. Mm-hmm. Plenty of times. He played Agod on A Day in the Life. One of the funniest episodes of Night Court you will ever find.
Ever. He also played Howard Guff in an episode of Previous Entry, Kolchak, the Night Stalker.
Yeah, we've talked about him a couple of times. Mm-hmm. By no means is this the first time we're going to talk about him. And honestly, it's probably not going to be the last time we're going to talk about him.
Spoiler, this isn't even the only time we're going to talk about him this week. He's going to appear on the next episode.
Episode 3, Susie's new job. After she loses her job as a dance teacher, Susie decides to complain to the White House. Well, it's Baltimore, so she would be really close by.
Doesn't Gerald Ford have more important things to do?
Like, you know, healing the country from the Nixon age.
And trying to avoid being eaten by wolves.
Guest on this episode is John J. Fox, who plays a colonel at the White House. He was the warden in Assault on Precinct 13. Episode 4, The Rent Increase.
What'd you say, Chico?
The rent increase!
The rent increase!
We're gonna increase the rent!
We're gonna increase the rent!
Want to see rent?
I want to see rent!
I want to see rent!
Ainsley's mother generates further problems for the Hotel Baltimore when she issues an unexpected rent increase to the tenants. Believing he could dissuade her, Ainsley instructs them to ignore his mother's order. However, he fails to halt the plans as promised, leaving everyone on the verge of being evicted onto the mean streets. The residents are moved to protest with a highly imaginative maneuver by the unseen Moose. I believe Moose is Bilotti's psychotic son.
That's what I was going to say. Probably the son of Charlotte Ray's character.
And we have a name in this episode. Playing the role of A.J. Horn, Dick Van Patten. The famous Van Patten family being represented on the podcast once again.
I was waiting for Greg to make a Timothy Van Patten reference.
Timothy Van Patten. Oh, God. Well, in all fairness, though, Timothy Van Patten is now a talented director.
Yeah, and Vince Van Patten is on World Poker Tour. He's been there for 20 years, it seems.
Oh, yes, and we all love Vince on World Poker Tour.
And of course, we did talk about Dick Van Patten personally on When Things Are Rotten because he was Friar Tuck.
Totally nailed that role.
Tomorrow, Abbott.
Tomorrow.
Welcome, Abbott.
Tomorrow.
Hello, Abbott.
Tomorrow.
Hey, Abbott.
I hate that guy.
Episode 5, George and Gordon. George and Gordon's latest spat promises to blossom into a hotel-wide fray. The famous lovers quarrel. All of a sudden, it becomes everyone's problem. Episode 6, The Date. Just to prove he's not afraid of anything, Bill agrees to take April out on a date. I could totally see that. Bill, the loving sort of glue that holds everything together, and April, a prostitute he could have an honest conversation with. Wonder what that would be like. Anyway, episode 7, The Deportation of Susie. Oh boy. Susie is threatened with deportation as an undesirable alien. So apparently she's run out of customers. I don't know. Play the role of Officer Arnold on this episode. I believe you might have talked about him before, Mike.
We have.
Ram Jarvis.
He played two roles, Mr. Merton and Mr. Simon, on probably one of the top 5 shows we've done, Get a Life. He was on the pilot, and also the pilot then turned into Terror in the Hell Loop 2000, and he was also on the Paperboy 2000 episode. And unfortunately, he wasn't on the episode where Brian Doyle Murray and Chris eat that alien. One of the funniest things ever.
Oh, guess what I'm holding?
Get a Life.
The Alien complete... Get a Life. Oh, you got the series. I didn't know that.
I got it a while back, yeah.
Oh, that's great.
The pre-read says on the top right here, the special non-anniversary edition.
Yeah, I think that they've only released it once because I got it like 10 years ago when it first came out. I paid way too much for it, but darn it, it's a great show.
It is a great show.
As we'd say around here, you're likely to spend more on less.
Yeah, definitely.
Absolutely.
Episode 8, Mrs. Bellotti's boyfriend. Residents at the Hotel Baltimore realize that love has come to one of their own. Aww. Mrs. Bellotti is falling deeply in love with Chapman Packer, the most wonderful guy in the world, but there's one significant hitch in their blossoming romance. Mrs. Bellotti's first love is her son, Moose, and everything hinges on a very successful meeting of the two men in her life.
Yet we don't see the two of them meeting.
Because we never see Moose.
Well, also, he's not credited in this episode.
Playing the role of her new boy toy is Peter Turgeon, who you would remember as Marcus Rathbone in the original Airport movie.
The only real credit of worthiness is for 12 episodes, he played a doctor and then the ghost of that doctor on Dark Shadows, the first season. So that means it probably reruns on Pluto TV's Dark Shadows channel every now and then, because I think they only show like the first one or two seasons.
He's more of a stage actor anyway. So, episode 9, Bingham's Con. Ex-convict Mojo Thompson arrives at the Hotel Baltimore in search of his old buddy, Charles Bingham. Mojo soon works his magic on the residents, enthralling him with wild tales of his former shenanigans. The problem is, in the process, he also happens to divulge a few secrets from Charles's past, things Bingham would rather keep dead and buried. Playing Mojo Thompson is Ron O'Neill, famous actor there. You probably remember him as Bella in Red Dawn, and also Whitley's father, Mercer Gilbert, in 4 episodes of A Different World. Sadly, no longer with us. He died at the age of 66 back in 2004. Episode 10, Historic L. Baltimore. Ainsley's mother has successfully targeted the Hotel Baltimore for a wrecking ball, hoping to save the building from an untimely demolition, which needs one, by the way. Clifford manages to have it declared an historic landmark. However, the scheme quickly backfires. With the building now more valuable than ever, a Japanese corporation decides to purchase it, but the unlikeliest of residents may prove to be the hotel's ultimate savior. And a whole lot of names in this one, playing the role of Mitsubishi. If we haven't talked about him on this podcast, we will. John Fujioka. He was in Tales of the Gold Monkey as Todo.
He was also on a couple episodes of recent entry, The Munsters Today.
Yep, I knew he talked about him. I knew it. He was all over the place in the 60s and 70s and 80s. Fun fact, here's Chico's neato fact of the day. He was originally credited as John Momo on 9 episodes of McHale's Navy, where he played a Japanese officer of some sort. And that is Chico's neato fact of the day.
Oh, neat!
But that's not even the biggest name of the cast. The guest cast, that is. Playing Travis, Bernie Capel. And if you don't know who Bernie Capel is, you're beyond help.
Second reference to When Things Were Rotten, because he was a regular on that.
Episode 11. Ainsley loves April. Danger registers at the Hotel Baltimore in the form of an armed gunman who invades the lobby and threatens the residents. His most formidable opponents turn out to be the unlikeliest of saviors, the hooker April. Having witnessed April's heroism, Clifford Ainsley suddenly sees her in a very different light. He falls head over heels in love with her, giving April a rare opportunity to be treated like a queen.
And the gunman isn't credited, so I think that means we're just going to move on to episode 12.
Yep. Episode 12, Susie's Problem. Susie, depressed about turning 30, feels like she's wasting her life after contracting a sexually transmitted disease.
Susan, what do you have to say?
Dude, yes, I was waiting for it.
Uh-oh.
I was waiting for that to happen. I just love that little pause that Greg put there. We didn't have an immediate Susan. It was a delayed Susan.
The delayed Susan.
That was great.
The only thing we're missing now is the unprompted Susan. Anyway, playing the role of Susie's priest is Charles White. Mostly, he was known as an actor from Your Mother's Stories, most notably The Edge of Night in 1980 and As the World Turns in 1979. He was also on Car 54, Where Are You? In an uncredited role as the aide to the mayor. While we're on a Car 54, Where Are You kick. Which, let's be honest, we should be. And the final episode, Ainsley's Secret. Evie, a woman from Ainsley's past, arrives at the Hotel Baltimore and issues a shocking accusation. She claims that Ainsley is the father of her child.
There's your unprompted Susan, Greg.
I believe we can mark that off the Susan St. James bingo card now. However, Ainsley vehemently declares his innocence. Ultimately, he agrees to settle the problem with a payoff to Evie. Although he couldn't possibly be the father, the reason he couldn't forms the crux of Ainsley's secret. Do we ever find out what Ainsley's secret is? No? Okay.
Hey, playing the role of Evie in this episode is Samantha Harper. Not really known for anything in terms of acting. She was married to Bill Macy from Maud. She's actually his widow.
That's the show. And we never find out what Ainsley's secret is because ABC canceled the show.
Yeah, I've got some information about that regarding the show and its eventual cancellation. Going through my usual newspaper searches, I have a story here from March 2nd of 1975. Viewers give Hot L. Baltimore cold shoulder. This is from William Hickey, television and radio editor. It looks as if the law of averages is finally caught up with Norman Lear, the whirlwind producer of several hit primetime television shows. His sixth and latest effort, Hot L. Baltimore, is going down the ratings drain. The much ballyhooed and somewhat controversial show has failed to attract an audience of sufficient size to ensure its viability since it debuted at mid-season and, of late, has tumbled to the bottom of the Nielsen ratings ladder. The best it has done is, oh, listen to this number. I think any TV show would kill for this number nowadays. The best it has done is a 25% share of the audience, which during the week in question was good for 35th place on a list of 60 shows rated. Last week, Hotel Baltimore was ranked 58th among 62 shows, and its share of audience had slipped to 21%. Lear, of course, has no thoughts about quitting on the show, for he has never subscribed to the sports world's ancient bromide that you can't win them all. While no one inside or outside the industry can predict the lifespan of a network television show, Hotel Baltimore has all the outward appearances of a program bound for electronic oblivion in the not too distant future. The show simply has too many major weaknesses as it is presently structured, not the least of which is a cast of characters who are unlikable to an alarming degree. As far as I'm concerned, it is not only those characters the script calls for, but the actors themselves. They irritate beyond words and arouse little, if any, sympathy. Granted, it is not an easy task for anyone to introduce 10 unfamiliar faces to television literally overnight, but I find myself able to tolerate only the Teddy Bear Hotel owner and the oft-confused Colombian hooker. The other members of the cast annoy in varying degrees, ranging from slightly to grossly, representing, as they do, exactly the types I would dread spending an hour with at the local pub. Apparently, not too many of the nation's viewers care to spend time with them either, for when your show drops into the 50s on the Nielsen charts, it means a mass tuning out is taking place all over the country. Lear's insistence that the average man should rush to embrace the oddballs of society is not all that bad a philosophy, but the vehicle he uses to enforce it is ill-conceived and ill-timed. Ill-conceived in the sense that the characters presented and the words and actions they employ are bound to create just the opposite effect among the citizenry. There is too much whining self-pity, not to mention questionable indignation, to arouse viewers' latent nobility. Lear's timing, so precise with All in the Family, is also off the mark by several years, in that the straits of the world are overburdened with their own problems and have little room left for citizens of society's nether class.
Well, apparently, the Hot L Baltimore had a big fan in the person who was running the network at the time. That would have been Michael Eisner. And Norman Lear actually explains this in this interview from the Academy of American Television.
I don't have time to talk about all of his shows, but obviously...
What do you mean?
Not all of them were hits. Your batting average would have been, it would be good enough to have gotten you into the Baseball Hall of Fame. But still, you had some what we would call...
We had some real misses and right. Some near misses.
Clinkers, but some that were sort of credits you wouldn't mumble. I mean, they were good
shows. I mean, I loved Hot L Baltimore was a noble effort. I mean, not a noble effort. It was a terrific show. Michael Eisner, to his everlasting credit, was running ABC at the time. Michael loved the show so much, and he's such a passionate guy. He told me three shows in, Norman, this show will never be picked up. The salesmen don't like selling it. It was about two hookers, if you recall. Two of the central characters were two prostitutes in a Hot L Baltimore was Hotel Baltimore, but the E had fallen out of the sign.
The origin of this property was a Broadway play.
Was a play, yeah. Lost the author's name. And we bought the rights to the play. And
you used a stage actor in the lead, I believe. James Cromwell?
Jimmy Cromwell was one of the leads. The two women have become...
Conchita
Farrell.
Yeah.
And... Richard Masser, great actor, and now president of the
Screen Actors Guild.
Right.
Who was also in One Day at a Time.
He was also in One Day at a Time, right. We had a terrific company of actors. And two guys who played two gay guys who were living together. So we had two prostitutes, two gay guys, in this hotel that was readily understandable as the place where all these people might live. We had a wonderful character whose son was called Horse, and he was some offstage character in some room upstairs, and she was always coming. Charlotte Ray was the mother. I loved the show, and Eisner loved the show and knew early on, but what I wanted to say about him was he never missed a taping. Despite the fact that the show would be off his network, he never missed a taping.
Michael Eisner attended every taping. Wow. Mm-hmm. I mean, he must have liked it. I mean, he's obviously done pretty well at the mouse. But, yeah, well, that's
Well, this would have been amazing. Was he at Paramount yet, or was this when he was working?
He was at ABC before he was at Paramount.
Okay, that explains it, yeah.
Yeah, he went to Disney from Paramount and started to run Disney the way he ran Paramount, which is why it succeeded so far in the 80s. And then fell off in the 90s, especially in the parks division.
Oh, yeah. And especially when he did those straight-to-video sequels to the animated movies.
Yeah. And if I may quote Kevin Perger of Defunctland, he had a bit of a unique strategy. It was called jealousy. Worked for him in the 70s and the 80s, the 90s, not so much.
As we do on just about every episode, I think we need to take a look at the schedule. And the schedule, I think, paints a picture here. In a number of ways, actually. Because Hot L Baltimore was scheduled for 9 o'clock on Friday nights.
Right.
On Friday nights on CBS, generally 80s. Was a movie or a special of some sort, not any sort of regular programming, but on NBC, there was a little show that just started its rookie campaign called The Rockford Files. But also, I'm going to give maybe a little credit to the scheduling here. After Hotel Baltimore was actually The Odd Couple. Now, admittedly, this is 75, so this is like the last season of The Odd Couple, but still, you've got The Odd Couple following Hotel Baltimore.
You know what was right before Hotel Baltimore? Another short-lived series, Kolchak the Night Stalker.
Yeah, we talked about that previously.
So, not a very good night for ABC those Fridays.
No, actually, I'm going to disagree with you because at 10 o'clock on Friday nights was a little show called Beretta.
Oh, Beretta.
Yeah, we don't talk that much about Robert Blake here. No. But still, Night Stalker, Kolchak the Night Stalker, beloved, probably one of the biggest cult series of all time. Odd Couple, what needs to be said about the original Odd Couple with Tony Randall and Jack Klugman and Beretta? I mean, those are, you know, really good shows. It's just then you have this sort of weak link in the middle of it. But also another thing I think that contributes to this, again, doing research on the schedules, not every affiliate showed Hot L Baltimore either at 9 o'clock Eastern at its usual time slot or at all period. Because taking a look here, I see that both Akron and Cleveland's ABC affiliates preempted Hot L Baltimore at least once each in the 13 weeks. And actually, the Cleveland affiliate showed an episode, believe it or not, 11:30 on Sunday nights after the late news. They really hid that episode.
I'll do you one better, Mike. The Baltimore affiliate, which at this point would probably be WJZ, if I'm not mistaken, didn't air it at all.
For some reason, I'm not surprised. I really am not surprised. I was thinking you're going to say that. Maybe because it casts a bad light on Baltimore, the city, or something like that. I'm really not surprised.
Yeah, if you wanted to watch it and you were in Baltimore, you had to tune into WJLA, which by then would have been WMAL. So,
so you had to get it out of DC, I assume?
You had to get it out of DC, yes.
So you couldn't watch Hot L Baltimore in the city it's set in?
No.
Amazing.
Amazing indeed. And interesting, too, because before this show, Norman Lear had 5 solid hits, All in the Family, Sanford and Son, Maude, Good Times, and The Jeffersons.
Well, like I said, from that news article, you know, you can't win all of them. But still, and I believe this is actually mentioned in the piece regarding Michael Eisner being a fan. If you look at his success ratio, his percentage, in baseball, he'd be in the Hall of Fame immediately. I mean, really, how many misses did he have? Maybe 3, a.k.a. Pablo, this show, and, oh, what we're going to cover next, but we'll talk about that in a little bit.
Well, he had more than 3. He did have misses like Hanging In, Not That One, All's Fair, The Nancy Walker Show, and 704 Hauser, the revival of All in the Family.
So, yeah, I mean, that's pretty much all there is to say about the Hot L Baltimore. I mean, it was seedy for its time, and so was the TV show. But it wasn't really revolutionary as much as his previous entries. For 5 straight series, Norman Lear gave us comedy to laugh at and to think about. For this 6th time, the first time on ABC with Hot L Baltimore, Norman Lear gave us this thing on TV.
Wow!
From Norman Lear,
Hotel Baltimore,
creator of All in the Family, Sanford and Son, another comedy milestone.
You cheat!
Why would I cheat, you abominable old wretch?
Because you are black.
What did you say?
I said you are black. I'm red. You're both the wrong gender.
Right.
Hot L. Baltimore.
And now for something completely different.
Like you've got something to say, do you?
Yes, I certainly do.
I have to go now. My planet needs me.
Episode 292, submission number 1718, A Year at the Top. A Year at the Top aired on CBS from August 5th to September 2nd, 1977, for five episodes.
Or depending where you look, it may have been six. It looks like there were six done. Maybe the pilot didn't air. We have a lot of conflicting information here. So even the episode titles that we're going to give, there's two totally different sets of episode titles. Who the heck knows what's going on here? This is really a tough show to pin information on. I mean, we don't even have a theme song. The only media that's out there literally is one, I think, 20-second promo.
But we do have evidence that this show did indeed exist and was indeed produced and reviewed and pretty much tossed aside like yesterday's garbage. Greg and Paul are rock musicians who leave their home in Boise, Idaho for Hollywood. They find Frederick J. Hanover, a promoter, who has found a lot of famous rock musicians. However, Greg and Paul learn that Hanover is the son of the devil. And in return for a year of fame and fortune, they must sign away their souls. Playing the roles of Greg and Paul are musician and actor Greg Evigan and musician and actor Paul Schaefer. Greg Evigan, of course, you know, from BJ and the Bear and My Two Dads. Paul Schaefer, of course, you know, as being Dave Letterman's comic foil.
And also, we know what show spun off from BJ and the Bear. The Misadventures of Sheriff Lobo. Oh, Miss Sheriff Lobo.
Now, you see, that's the second Simpsons reference in like 3 minutes. I was going to make a reference to Bart selling his soul to Milhouse.
Sheriff Lobo. Yeah.
Definitely.
So we've had a Homer Simpson Sheriff Lobo reference, and we've sort of indirectly referred to when Bart sold his soul to Milhouse.
And we've also talked about Poochie with Vince.
Oh my gosh, we've had three in like 5 minutes.
Wait, people don't know this yet because we're still celebrating Norman Lear's 100th birthday. But as we record this,
hold on.
This is CNN breaking news.
Yeah, apparently at like 4:30 today, Vince McMahon stepped down as CEO of WWE.
Yeah, you know, 4:30 on a Friday. You know what that's called?
You have to release this news so the stock doesn't tank.
That's called a Friday night news dump.
Man, how bad must those hush money payouts he gave to all those women be?
I could not tell you. I honestly could not tell you.
Listen, don't have a bunch of, like, mistresses on the side and then give hush money payouts hoping that it'll go away. It doesn't.
Okay, so back to this show, which aired in the summer of 1977, like literally right before the new season began. So you can imagine how much confidence CBS has in it.
We'll talk about that later because there's actually a little story behind it.
Oh, okay. Well, there is the matter of the man who plays Frederick J. Hanover, a.k.a. the son of the devil. He's played by Gabriel Dell, who you would probably remember as... What would you remember him as?
That's all you need to know. What would you remember him as?
Oh, you know what? Remember Legends? Remember we talked about Legends of the Superheroes? He played Mordrew in both episodes.
Yeah, but look at the credit below that. He voiced Boba Fett on the Star Wars Holiday Special.
Previous entry of the Star Wars Holiday Special. Oh, and by the way, when the Guardians of the Galaxy Holiday Special comes out later on this year, we're going to do a live watch of the Star Wars Holiday Special.
Oh, man, I thought we were going to do a live watch of the Guardians of the Galaxy.
Oh, we'll do that, too.
That's where I thought he was going, too. But also, we should mention, and I'm sure you know, Legends of the Superheroes, also former previous entry.
Yeah, episode 149.
Yeah, but mostly he's known as the voice of Boba Fett in his debut performance in the Star Wars Holiday Special, to which I had to say, you don't sound like Temuera Morrison to me.
No, you don't sound like Aquaman's dad. Hey, you didn't make it with Nicole Kidman and make a kid.
Whoa, hello. Other characters on this show include Trish, played by Julie Cobb, who is known as Yeoman Leslie Thompson in a 1968 episode of Star Trek, but mostly a few of your mother's stories and one episode of Salt Stalkings.
Well, no, it looks like she was on a season, possibly the CBS season before it went to syndication, of Charles in Charge.
Wait, yes. She was the mother on Charles in Charge?
Jill Pembroke, yes.
Jill Pembroke.
Wait, well you know that. You know what that means? Her on-screen husband would be...
Yeah.
J.B. Widows.
Yeah. I think we saw that coming. And also, taking a look at her credits, she was on, looks like, A Week of Tattletales in 1977. And you won't believe, I don't know if this is her husband or boyfriend at the time. Actually, oh my God. You go into the details on IMDb, and there's this paints so many pictures. When she was on Tattletales, she was on with Victor French. That was her husband at the time. And they actually got divorced later on in 77. But who did she marry in 1986 and then divorce in 2006? We talked about him the last episode, James Cromwell.
I have questions.
Oh, I thought when he went in 1986, you were going to say John Shuck, and then my mind would have been totally blown.
Hey. No, that was Nimoy.
That was Leonard's wife. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But yeah, Julie Cobb is both the ex-wife of Victor French and James Cromwell.
I have questions.
Okay. The chair recognizes Chico. Question number one.
Does this mean she's the ex-wife of Zefram Cochrane, who discovered warp drives and enabled humanity to go into space?
Yes.
I honestly have no idea what the hell you're even talking about.
At least Greg's got me. Greg,
that's James Cromwell's character in First Contact.
Okay, all right.
But also, hold on a second. I should also mention, because we talked about Victor French, one of the greatest discoveries I've made is on Freevee. They have a Highway to Heaven channel. And you know who was recently on one of the episodes on the Highway to Heaven channel?
Oh.
You know, I think you should all be nicer to Will Wheaton.
The way I treat my colleagues... Wait, what?
I said you ought to be nicer to Will Wheaton.
You mean Will Wheaton?
Yes, Will Wheaton.
Why are you saying it like that?
Well, I'm just saying you should be nicer to Will Wheaton. Will Wheaton seems like a nice guy.
Say wheat.
Wheat.
Now, say Will Wheaton.
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 Hey, did you hook up with Whoopi Goldberg on the show?
All the time.
He's not wrong. Greg actually shared a picture with us. Oh, my gosh. So, Trish was played by the ex-wife of James Cromwell and Victor French. This episode just got a lot more interesting, I think.
Yeah.
Excuse the term, but a throwaway actress. We just like fell in love with her because she had two really famous ex-husbands.
Basically, but how's about this for a throwaway actress? Definitely not a throwaway actress, actually. Priscilla Morrill, who played Miss Worley on the show. Of course, she was known as Mrs. Risendoe on 3 seasons of Coach, and Marion Vanderkellen on 4 seasons of Newhart. I believe that was...
That's Stephanie's mom.
Stephanie's mom, yeah.
Julia Duffy's character's mom, yeah.
And then she played Lucille on the In a Bed of Roses episode of The Golden Girls. Or, if I'm quoting Dashiell Driscoll, the episode of The Golden Girls where Rose a stranger to death.
Rose Nyland?
Yep.
I thought she was the clean one. That would be a Blanche thing.
Nope.
A person to death.
Nope. Rose Nyland was somebody's side piece, and that somebody died, and Rose had to tell the sister, and it turned out to be his wife. There was a very special episode about this on YouTube.
Uh-oh.
What? I'm sorry. I thought Rose Nyland was just this innocent, naive woman, and she was somebody's side piece.
Ooh, yeah. And another interesting role I just found, she played Sister Lillian in 9 episodes of Future Entry in the beginning with McLean Stevenson.
If only we had footage of In the Beginning. Oh, well.
If anything, this episode gives us more of a reason to do In the Beginning than before, because we don't, well.
Didn't our friend Adam Nita found an interesting fact about In the Beginning?
I don't know. I'll ask him.
Well, we have to ask Adam. I know he found like something from In the Beginning in the preview episodes that he had an astute observation on, which I will not share here because Adam knows.
Adam knows. Okay.
Adam, if you're listening, I know.
And rounding out the cast as Grandma Belle Durbin, which is apparently the grandmother of either Greg or Paul. Mike, put your pants back on. Nedra Voles.
How did you know they're off?
Lucky guess. Anyway.
You said Nedra Voles' name wrong, you ass.
Okay, I'll try that again. Mike, put your pants back on.
They already went back on when you called her Nedra Voles.
Nedra Voles.
Oh, they just came off.
Put your pants back on.
And really, what do we need to say about Nedra Voles? Eventual Hall of Famer. And damn it, I will make sure she gets in the Hall of Fame.
Seriously, what hasn't been said about Nedra Voles at this point?
She made Match Game Hollywood Squares Hour.
My ass, she made Match Game Hollywood Squares Hour.
Oh. Well, who did? Leonard Fry?
Yes, he did.
Yes. No, you're both wrong. You're both wrong. It was Brian Stokes Mitchell wearing a stalk of celery like he was the Fifth Doctor. That's what made the Match Game Hollywood Squares Hour. I will entertain no follow-up questions.
Well, okay, then. I think we need to look at some episodes. Even though, really, we don't have any semblance of an episode guide. There's nothing on IMDb. There's nothing on Wikipedia. I've gone through my sources. I couldn't find a thing. Jaco, did you find anything on, like, TV.com or something like that?
I didn't find anything on TV.com. I didn't find anything on EpGuides.com. The closest I found was 2 episodes on lostmediawiki.com.
Well, that's better than nothing. But I mean, even when I look at Wikipedia versus IMDb in terms of episode titles, They're a different set of episode titles. I don't even see anything that matches except pilot. Because duh.
An interesting thing about the pilot, which either aired or didn't air, depending on your market, you know what the original premise of the show was? It was going to be a trio of performers who sold their soul to the devil for a year of success. And rounding out that trio was Mickey Rooney. That pilot did not make air, but he did make the pilot in this show.
And actually, that explains why IMDb has 6 episodes and Wiki has 5, because of the unaired pilot. And actually, I got a little bit more information about that unaired pilot. So yeah, instead of being about 2 performers, it was about 3. And those 3 performers strike a deal with the devil for both youth and also a year at the top of the music industry. And it was supposed to start January 19th of 77 at 8:30 on CBS. Then the premiere was set for January 26th. And actually on January 10th, this is from an article on January 11th, production was shut down for quote unquote alterations, with the production set to resume in March for a debut in the fall. And in addition to Mickey Rooney, some of the other names that were in this pilot, Robert Alda, who we've talked about quite a bit, and actually second episode in a row we're mentioning this name, Phil Leeds.
So Mickey Rooney would return for the pilot to this show as Uncle Mickey Durbin. It would be the Deidre Volz role, but it would actually obviously be his uncle instead of his nana. And this would be perhaps the episode where they move from Idaho to make it big in the music business in Los Angeles, only to sell their soul to the devil. And in this episode, we have a couple of names. First one is Priscilla Lopez, who you would remember from Be Positive and Made in Manhattan, as Linda. As Billy Worthy, we have somebody we may talk about in the future, Tim Thomerson.
We talked about Tim Thomerson.
Well, we talked about him before, but we may talk about him again in the future. Because if I'm not mistaken, he was in
Down and Out in Beverly Hills. Remember that?
And he was on at least 1 week of Match Game Hollywood Scores Out.
Well, we know that, yes.
Well, I know that. Yeah, I know you know that.
Yep. And he played Gene in Pork, the Transmute Navigator. By the way, 13 Week Theater has a really good feature on Pork.
And I'm going to throw out one more name. Starring as a desperate man, maybe starring isn't the best word to use. Robert Starr, I mentioned him for 2 reasons. One, he was on an episode of Wings in 1995.
Wait a minute. Hold up a second.
He was on an episode of Wings.
Yes, guys.
In 1995. Hold on. I have to get myself ready for this. I have a feeling I'm going to hear some.
But this is
going to
be a story because you've never heard this before.
This is some earth shattering shit I'm about to hear.
Hey, Chico, get the other folks in the condo for this.
Okay, hold on, Joe, JD, get in here. Not many of you know this, but I'm actually.
I have an important announcement to make, guys.
Joe, JD. If you guys can hear me, you want to get in here? Greg has an important announcement to make. I'm switching my Zoom. I'm switching my Zoom audio. So everybody.
Oh, yeah. By the way, Chico's in Vegas. For those of you who have been wondering, why is it sounds so acoustic-y with Chico's background? That's why he's in Vegas.
I am in Vegas. Greg has an announcement to make, and I'm going to go ahead and put it in the speaker here. here.
Yeah, all of Vegas needs to hear this.
Y'all need to hear this. Go for it.
This is an announcement I've never told a single person about this, but I'm finally ready to announce it to everybody, okay? All right. Are you ready? This is very tough for me to say, but I'm going to finally admit it. I love wings.
Greg!
Did you all know that I love wings?
I heard him in the background.
And you know why I love wings? It made Tony Shalhoub's career.
Oh my gosh.
Whenever you watch The Marvelous Miss Maisel, remember, it made Tony Shalhoub's career. Wings.
Damn right it do.
That's why he's on Marvelous Miss Maisel, and that's why he's making the big money.
Aren't you guys shocked? My man. Wow. Joe?
He's speechless.
And by the way, did you know I love Rachel Brosnan too? Well, everyone does, but I just thought I'd mention that along with me loving Wings.
Okay.
Oh, I said there are two things I want to mention. There's actually three things now. Thank you, Greg.
You off now.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah,
I'll get you when I'm done.
Okay. So he was on, as I mentioned, an episode of Wings in 1995.
Grego, you magnificent bastard.
This is even better than the Herb Abrams bit with Kiesler.
That's all.
This is great.
Oh, Jason, do you know about Herb Abrams? He died.
No, baby, he's gone.
Cocaine.
He's gone.
Oh,
he's
damn
gone.
It.
He's gone.
Damn it.
He gone.
This is all okay. Staying, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So I originally said that there were two things I wanted to mention about Robert Starr. Because of Greg, now there's three because I was able to do a little bit of research. So, yes, he was on a 1995 episode of Wings.
Yes, and also?
He was on the pilot to Misfits of Science.
Yes, he was.
Yeah, and that's actually the revelation I had while Greg was declaring his love for Wings. But even, I don't know if necessarily bigger, but I'm making a connection here. He was in Airplane in 1980. He played Religious Zealot number 5. And you're saying, why are you bringing this up?
Is that the scene where Robert Stack's beating up all those people in the airport?
Yes. But that's not the reason I mentioned the connection to Airplane. This is Religious Zealot number 5. Do you know who played Religious Zealot number 1?
Who?
The guy who took out that guy's knee on Few, Greg Itzen.
Oh, God damn it. I didn't know Gregory Itzen was in Airplane.
Yeah, Gregory Itzen is one of
the people Robert Stack beats up.
I don't know if he beats him up, but he at least like gives a flower or a pamphlet to somebody.
I guess you know what? I bet Robert Stack saw that episode and wanted his piece.
So those are the three reasons I brought up Robert Starr. Not really noteworthy otherwise, but Wings, Misfits of Science pilot. And he was a religious zealot on Airplane, along with Gregory Itzen.
Right. Well, the pilot that did make it to air was, it aired on August 5th, 1977, The Big Deal. And we didn't have the Mickey Rooney character, but we had Nedra Volz as Grandma Belle Durbin. So they sort of did a whole gender flip sort of situation on that. But aside from that, it's basically the same premise.
So it may be, I'm guessing it's sort of like Get a Life in the sense that maybe the pilot that was done for in like early January or late 76, maybe it was the same pilot, but just with different characters, maybe a little bit of rewriting, reshooting. Because again, as I mentioned earlier, they did stop production in early January of 77, slated to resume in March. And even that, I don't think necessarily took off.
Right.
And as I said earlier, all we have is episode titles. And even from this point forward, we've got different episode titles of the 5 episodes. For example, episode 2, IMDb says it's called The Handshake. And Wikipedia says it's called The Contracts. Boy, I wonder what that's about. Handshake and contracts.
Well, I have it here from lostmediawiki.com.
Oh, good. Damn buzzing. Okay. Oh, that was Jose.
That was your eugenics?
You saw Julie Cobb.
No. Greg. This is my diabetes monitor. I have to keep it on. Yeah, it beeps whenever I go over a certain level, and apparently the cauliflower pushed it over that level, and I can't turn it off.
Oh, damn it. Even more funny if it was new jets.
Okay.
What's that, Mike? It's not new jets. I'm not aroused by Greg Evigan.
I'm sorry. Aroused by Julie Cobb. Oh, sorry.
Nedra Voles, get it right.
So, either the handshake or the contract, the episode is Greg and Paul are shocked to learn that Hanover's precious clients were only successful for a year. That's it.
I'm kind of not surprised, because this premise was actually played out on an episode of Married with Children in its final season, where Al Bundy sells his soul to the devil so he could play for the Chicago Bears and get them to a Super Bowl. They get to the Super Bowl, but the stipulation is, as I said, he wanted to get the Bears to the Super Bowl. He didn't say he wanted the Bears to win the Super Bowl. So he lost all his powers. He's back to being a 50-year-old man at the conclusion of the episode, and he's getting his butt handed to him 8 ways to Sunday. So it's not like it's a necessarily new premise, if you will.
Yeah, the whole series is, you know, one giant exercise in Faustian bargains and being extremely careful what you wish for. And episode 3, IMDb has it as Identity Crisis. Wikipedia has it as Tightrope. According to Lost Media Wiki, Paul and Greg struggle to retain focus. So I guess they're going to try and, you know, make this year for what it's worth and try and at least beat the devil in his own game. Good luck with that, huh? Episode 4, Love Story.
Wait, is this going to have Ryan O'Neal and Ally McGraw in it?
No.
Oh.
With the alternate title off of Wikipedia, The Visits.
Yeah. Again, not much known about this episode.
I'm guessing one of them falls in love because their girlfriend or ex-girlfriend or somebody they care about is visiting. I mean, it makes sense. Love story, The Visits. Okay. There's visiting, apparently, and love story. So it's got to be someone falls head over heels in love. Got to be something like that.
Got to be something like that. And episode 5, The Sun Also Rises, or Gray is Beautiful, depending on what source you're taking from. I'm guessing, I don't know, somebody notices a gray hair or something. I don't know what this episode is about, and it has not shown up in any of the research that we all did. So, yeah, a whole lot of research for not a lot of content. At least not for the episodes themselves. The show, on the other hand, had a pretty interesting story. And we went over bits and pieces of it as we were talking about the episodes. The show was created by a writer for our previous entry from Monday, Heywood Kling. And it was produced by Norman Lear and Don Kirshner,
who we've talked about previously on, and I'm sorry, Greg, I love this series, Musical Chairs.
You see what I'm doing?
Like Musical Chairs.
You see what I'm doing? I'm doing the Yankees thumbs down guy pose.
It's like,
well, everybody's got an opinion. I respect that.
It's like, Greg does not like Musical Chairs.
I just thought it was boring.
He loves Adam Wade, though.
Who doesn't? is Adam Wade.
And also, I'm Don Kushner. Welcome to Rock Concert. I had to throw that in there. So, a mastermind of television, a mastermind of televised music, get together and make a televised musical series. That doesn't really hit anywhere, does it? In fact, I managed to scrounge up an article here from the Washington Post around the time this show was released. Let's see what I can suss from Tom Shales here. Like the old Warner Brothers musicals of the 30s, A Year at the Top, premiering on CBS Tonight, gets much of its energy and its excuse for charm from the combined talents of young upstarts and old fogies in the cast. Year has taken at least 2 years to go from concept stage to the air, if not the top and its premise. The Devil Trading Souls for Fame hasn't been what you call fresh in 20 years, but the show still has vitality and friendly clownishness that makes Cummings like finding a Dairy Queen in Death Valley. Unfortunately, for all concerned, Mickey Rooney stars only in tonight's two shows. The taped inserts of him have been added to later ones. These were taped about 6 months ago after Year had already gone through several incarnations and was heading for more. The property is a checkered, striped, and polka-dotted history. 2 years ago at noon on Thanksgiving Day, NBC showed a pilot version called The Hereafter. It was about a bunch of old-timers who sold their souls to become flashes in the great pan of rock and roll. A spokesman for Norm Lear said, "Nobody saw that show but Norman." After all that, you might expect a perfected gem. Don't. The Edsel must have gone through rewrites too, but Year, which is now about a pair of kids who sell their souls for 12 months of fame, has enough going to make it unlikely as a replacement for a CBS flop to come. Some viewers may object to Gabriel Dell's flamboyant swishiness of the part of the Devil's Son, but he has such a good time pronouncing Boise as Boise that he's pretty hard to resist. It's a superb and sustained fame characterization. The two boys who go for ultimate broke are played by Greg Evigan and Paul Schaefer, but they're both unstaged in the opener by Priscilla Lopez, a chorus line columns, as a brassy Broadway babe in arms. Lopez, like Rudy, went on to other commitments after taping the pilot, and her character will be replaced in future shows. Though Rudy is making a movie in canon and will be phased out of the show, his replacement offers great hope. Nedra Voles, 63, appears as Rudy's mother on tonight's show and will assume his role as exorcist when he leaves. Nedra Voles as an exorcist. Good as Year at the Top pretty much is, it remains perturbing that its past problems couldn't have been worked out at the script stage. As usual, it's a little astonishing how many people share credit for such elemental inspiration. The show was created by Woody Kling, developed by Norman Lear, produced by Daryl Hickman, and the rock segments were developed in association with Don Kushner. Somehow, too many cooks have managed to come up with an appetizing broth. You know what? Tom Shales is one of the great TV critics of our time. But even Tom Shales gets it wrong once or twice. Because, Mike, do we have ratings for this show?
The only thing I have is in a passing mention, not even related to this show. It mentions that, I forget what was at the top of the ratings, but it said that Dead Last was A Year at the Top. And if you're dead last in the ratings, yeah, you're not going to last more than those initial five shows. And really, yeah, you look at this, it premiered in August of 77. If that doesn't say burn off, what does? Unless, you know, the burn off happens to produce good ratings. But yeah, I mean, literally one of the articles said that the previous week's episode was the worst rated show on television that week. So yeah, your time is very limited.
Yeah, this was actually supposed to be aired in January, like you said, but it was ultimately swept under until August. So my guess is CBS looked at what they saw in January, which was 5 episodes, and these were the 5 episodes. They still had a contractual obligation to Lear. They aired the 5 episodes, but they aired them in a way that it would not damage the network, it would not damage anyone's careers, and they would basically still be contractually obligated to air those episodes.
No, I'm going to disagree with you, because remember, we just talked about the pilot back in January, and at that point, Norman Lear said it wasn't ready to be put on television. So this is definitely not a CBS thing. They didn't do 5 episodes. They did a pilot, but it had to be retinkered. And as I mentioned earlier, they were looking at restarting it or re-recording it in March. So by no means did they have any of the 5 episodes done at that point. It looks like it was just like a pilot to start, maybe. But I do have an article here. This is actually a part of an article by William Hickey, another television critic, talking about Summer of 77 TV shows. Starting in the second paragraph of this article, A Year at the Top is the latest Norman Lear effort and is something of a departure for that man of comedy in that this show tries to combine music with laughs, a musical sitcom, if you will. The new CBS TV miniseries, that might say something right there too. It says miniseries. It doesn't say a full-fledged series, just miniseries. The new CBS TV miniseries features two youthful songwriter singers played by Greg Evigan and Paul Schaefer, who are tempted by the son of Satan to exchange their souls for superstardom on the musical stage. Satan Jr. is overplayed by Gabe Dell, a one-time dead-end kid. Mickey Rooney has the role of their uncle and father confessor, and presumably he will attempt to stave off Satan Jr.'s devilish plans. Priscilla Lopez of Chorus Line fame plays Greg's girlfriend and joins Rooney, the good, in his angelic scheming. In its first outing, the network combined the first 2 episodes, which only added to the general confusion of the plot line, but then it will hardly matter in the long run. In fact, if CBS TV schedules this show into its regular lineup, it will only go to prove that the network is desperate for replacement shows. Actually, it wasn't a dreadful show, but rather one that is definitely ho-hum. The script was workable in parts, but the musical segments were better, which isn't saying a whole lot other than that the two young men possess charisma. This was the show that was slotted into CBS TV's primetime schedule last year, but was yanked off by Lear himself. He said at the time that he didn't feel it was ready for weekly play. I've got news for Norman. It still isn't ready. Yeah. So it looks like that they wanted this to possibly air as early as, I'm guessing, fall 76, but Lear pulled it. And then, again, we talked about January. They did the pilot, and production stopped in January, slated to resume in March. It seems like it was a good idea, just sort of maybe half-baked.
Yeah, it wasn't all the way there. But there was a bit of a legacy on this show. Greg Evigan and Paul Schaefer did release an album with songs from the show.
But also related, the theme music was released commercially. Problem is, it's not out there. But the theme music, one of the composers, not surprising at all, Paul Schaefer.
Not a shock. Actually, fun fact, it's time for Chico's Nito Fact of the Day. Paul Schaefer wrote the theme music to this show. Greg Evigan sang it. That's a fun fact. That's a fun fact.
Oh, neat!
That's really the only lasting legacy of this show. And frankly, nobody's career was harmed by this. And Greg Evigan, of course, would be one of the My Two Dads. Paul Schaefer, of course, would be the leader of the world's most dangerous band / the CBS orchestra. Julie Cobb would be James Widows' wife. Nedra Voles would be, come on, she's Nedra Voles. And people are still selling their souls to the devil for televised fame to this day. I mean, Faustian bargains, not a new concept, but it did make for a very interesting thing on TV.
Why do you make it sound like we're done with the show?
Is there anything else to talk about this show? Because I am all ears.
Yeah, play the music. All right, I got two items.
Ooh, two items.
Greg, I'm going to ask you, do you want the left hand or the right hand?
Right hand.
You want the right hand? Okay. So the left hand was a script from A Year at the Top, The Big Deal Part 2. So that was the second half hour of the hour-long premiere episode. And if you're actually genuinely curious, that was $44.99. But what we're playing for now, how about the album A Year at the Top? The full album, not the 45.
Oh, yes. The full album.
With this is Greg Evigan and Paul Schaefer on the full album.
This is what I always wanted. Greg Evigan and Paul Schaefer in one album.
And this, you're so enthusiastic, Greg. And this is by Greg and Paul, and the title is A Year at the Top. And just a little bit about the item. It's vinyl, obviously, as you'd probably expect. Artist name is Greg Evigan, Paul Schaefer. Title is A Year at the Top. Condition used. Cover is actually graded an excellent between very good and M minus, probably near mint, let's say that. Media condition is near mint. The disc is nearly perfect. It may have been played a few times. It should play perfectly. Sleeve condition is very good plus. And we have a list of the tracks here. She's a Rebel. Like a Rising Star, Give Me More. We've Come So Far. A Year at the Top, which I'm going to assume is the theme song possibly, especially since it's only 56 seconds long and not 2 to 3 minutes like everything else. We're Lovers After All, Good Time Girl, Sweet Love, Love Just Comes and Goes, and You Are the One. So we'll do this in dollars and cents, and Greg selected the item, so I'm going to go with Chico first. And this is a buy it now. It's an active buy it now. So if you want it, you can head over to eBay right now and snag it.
$69.
Nice, Greg.
$71.
Oh my gosh, you are way over.
Oh,
you're over. I should have said you're over, but you're way over.
Okay.
Okay.
So the $69 is the lowest bid.
$42.
Greg?
$44.
You're still over.
Oh, for the love of... Okay.
Chico, let's try it again.
All right. I need about $350.
$350, okay.
I need about $350.
All right, Greg.
$5.
You know, when I said you guys are way over, I didn't think you'd drop it by $20 or so. This is yours if you want to buy it now. $18.49.
Hmm. Well...
And actually, if I take a look at this, I need to use my magnifying glass tool, but I believe this has the original price stickers on it.
Oh, are we going to do the not eBay prices right with the original price sticker?
No, I was just going to give you a comparison.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. I see two prices here. I don't know if one is like retail MSRP and the other's the price it was selling at in the store. But I see a $6.98. And then below it is $4.80. So it looks like you could have this for $5 back in the day or under $5. So yeah, $18.49. I'm actually tempted. I'm tempted. I mean, how many of these are out there, do you think? Probably not a lot.
Don't know.
I'm really tempted to take a chance at this so we can hear the theme song. But also, really, how often have we heard Paul Schaefer singing in a non-Letterman sort of format in terms of him doing his little vamping and whatnot between segments? He doesn't sing all that much.
No. And also, this is 77, right?
This is 77, so this is when he was on SNL.
Yeah, with Howard Shore, yeah. Oh, by the way, speaking of Howard Shore, he's doing the music for the Lord of the Rings Amazon series that's coming out. They just announced that because he did the music for the movies, obviously. So
I'm very tempted to buy this just because I have a turntable downstairs that one of my exes gave me, and I think it can hook up to a computer so I could record MP3s and stuff like that. That might be an experiment. Maybe that's the one good thing that X gave me, is that turntable that maybe if I hook it up, we'll be able to get something from this show. And this might be music from the show. I mean, I mentioned the theme, but this may be actual music from the show, I'm saying. Who knows?
Maybe, possibly.
And actually, if you go on eBay, I am surprised by how many photos they have for sale from this show. I'm not even joking. Just taking a quick look at this, there's 36 results, active results for a year at the top in quotes. And if I'm making a guess, between ads and press photos and other types of advertising media, photos and, you know, paper material and stuff, not counting the script, not counting the record, there must be about 30 different types of photos or ads or whatnot for this show, for something that lasted 5 weeks. I think that's pretty amazing. So yeah, if you want to get all your Mickey Rooney and Paul Schaefer and Greg Evigan photos from a year at the top, they're like 15, 20 bucks a piece, but knock your socks off. And one more thing I want to talk about before we call it a show: the schedule. Because, you know, where was it airing? What did it go up against? I can tell you this: it did air on Sunday nights on CBS at 8:30. And actually, its lead-ins, two very good ones. I mean, obviously, 60 Minutes started the evening like it has for 50 years, it seems. And then at 8 was Rhoda. And this would have been the third season of Rhoda, the fourth season? It wasn't the last season, I don't think. So Rhoda still had at least a year or two left. But then the competition on ABC, and this, I think, would have been the first season of this show, the second half hour of the $6 Million Man.
That'll do it. That'll do it all day.
If that doesn't do it, this might. I believe at this point on NBC was the mystery movie of the week, because there was a 90-minute McCloud. But also, if it's the mystery movie of the week, then you've got Columbo in that mix. So, yeah, not good when you're going up against Lee Majors and one of the big shows of 1976 and the mystery movie of the week.
And as a reminder, this was during the summer, so it would be up against reruns of said shows, which still commanded an audience, as evidenced by the fact that this episode, or at least one episode of A Year at the Top, placed dead last.
And also about McCloud, this would have actually been the last season. Actually, at this point, it would have been in reruns. McCloud ended in April of 77, so it was in reruns at that point. But also, Greg, just doing some quick research, you won't believe who was one of the stars of McCloud in the final two seasons.
Okay, tell me.
Dynamoldar.
Oh, no.
Have we fixed the elevator yet?
I really don't want to talk about it.
I guess that's a no. Okay.
But yeah, so it was going up against whatever mystery movie NBC was showing, whether it was Lanigan's Rabbi, Quincy early on before it became a full-fledged series, Columbo, McCloud.
McMillan?
It looks like, yeah, McMillan, I think, would have ended around this time because it looks like the mystery movie ended in 77, and I believe that's when McMillan and Wife ended, too.
Hold on. I got a joke. Do you know what Susan St. James' reaction to the cancellation of McMillan and Wife was?
Get it out of your system. Get it out of your system.
That was her reaction when they found out they were killing her character and McMillan was going to spend the next season by himself.
And also, since we're talking about McMillan Wife, if you get cozy, they show, I think, two episodes of McMillan and Wife every Saturday. Or maybe it's one on Saturday and one on Sunday. But if you need your Susan fix, go to Cozy. It's like, I think Saturday afternoons or Saturday at noon, they show McMillan and Wife. Plus also, not only do you get your Susan fix, you get your John Shuck fix. I knew you guys would enjoy that.
Everyone loves John Shuck.
Yeah, in fact, I'm going to try an experiment. John Shuck. There you go.
One last thing before we go, a quickie correction. When I was talking about Car 54, Where Are You, on Monday's episode, I mentioned Ed Gwynn. I meant Fred Gwynn. I think I got Fred Gwynn and Ed Wynn mixed up. Sorry about that.
We have all of John Shuck's episodes.
Shuckapalooza.
Over at itwasathingontv.com with the rest of our episodes. We're getting close to 300, and we have stuff planned for 300. I think you're going to enjoy it. But in the meantime, you have to get there, and part of getting there is revisiting a show that we talked about early on the podcast, but we only glanced over it as part of a bigger subject. We'll talk about the episodes and the TV show in full next Monday. And then, because baseball, and also because reboots, we're going to talk about a TV show about baseball that is having a reboot.
Oh, yes. It's coming soon to Prime Video, as a matter of fact.
Yep.
And I can't wait for it, to be honest.
I know you can't, but in the meantime, you can follow us on all social media at It Was a Thing on TV, except for Facebook, where we are at It Was a Thing on TV podcast. And of course, we're also on the Place to Be Nation. We talked about that on Monday. And we're also on the YouTube. Don't forget to like, subscribe, share our videos, hit that notification bell. And you will stay up to date with all of our subjects, including the ones we just mentioned, which are coming next week right here on It Was a Thing on TV. Thank you for listening. For Mike, for Greg, I'm Chico. Please be kind to each other, and we will see you for the next one.
Wow!
Greg falls for the beautiful Kelly Christopher.
She loves me.
But she, too, has a deal with the devil.
It's midnight. Bye-bye time.
A Year at the Top. Sunday at 8:30, 7:30 Central and Mountain.